Good morning. Dr. Allen is kind of my academic grandfather. I was on the soil judging team at Cornell University, and Ray Bryant was my coach. And I had the pleasure of first meeting Dr. Allen, I hate to admit how many years ago, at soils contests. And it was a real pleasure in 2010 to see Dr. Allen again at the 50th anniversary of the soils contest, where the contest was hosted by Dr. Wayne Hudnall and his group at Texas Tech. Well, following in Dr. Allen's footsteps, I too am a desert rat, and I'm here today to talk at the request of Susan and Wayne about soil-plant relationships, and Susan asked if I would address something about digital soil mapping, and we'll see if I can squeeze all that in less than 15 minutes. We've heard many different reports this morning about how environmental factors influence soil formation, and organisms, you know, plants, in general, are the primary producers of organic carbon to our soil ecosystems. But in arid environments, it's characterized by low plant cover. Now, this low plant cover means that the plant community is very strongly influenced by the soil properties. So we have this feedback relationship. The particle size distribution, the depth to a root-restricting layer, the mineralogy, chemistry, for example, salinity or potentially toxic trace elements, is going to influence the plant cover. It's going to take on a little tour here. First, we're going to start in the Basin and Range physiographic province in the Mojave Desert ecoregion. We have soils on these coalescent alluvial fans or bajadas coming down from the Sheep Mountains. Luria tridentata, Luria tridentata or creosote bush, very common on these big alluvial fans. Deep soils, gravelly textures, but no root-restricting layers. We have a similar system here in a different part of the Sheep Mountains, the Bajada from the Sheep Mountains, where we instead have carbonatic mineralogy to the soil. And so we change out the creosote bush for Ambrosia dumosa. In some of our younger geomorphic surfaces that still are deep, no root-restricting layers, that have some rock fragments, mixed mineralogy, we get a different vegetation cover as well. In some other areas where we have the desert pavement that we had a very nice talk by Bob Graham, we often find that there's a desert pavement, a different vegetation community, and the soils are different. In this case, it's because we have soils that are shallow to moderately deep to a petrocalcic horizon with some rock fragments in the surface, but more of a mixed mineralogy. And then we have geomorphic surfaces in the basin floor type environments where we have shallow soils to petrocalcic horizon and carbonatic mineralogy, as well as probably 60 to 80% of the finer or of the soil dominated by carbonate nodules, cemented carbonate nodules. And this is the habitat for one of our rarest plants in the Las Vegas Valley, one of them here being Areogonum corymbosum variety nilesii, and then this really cute, you can barely see it, this really cute Las Vegas bear poppy, the Arctomecon californica. Let's move down to the Jornada experimental range on the Jornada del Muerto. And I'm sure many of you have been on those tours to see these beautiful Chihuahuan grasslands and how in many places the Chihuahuan grasslands are being invaded by a native plant, the mesquite. Being invaded meaning the Chihuahuan grasslands are being converted to this small tree or shrubland. And there's some people, quite a bit of work down there where the depth to this petrocalcic horizon seems to predispose sites to their invasion by these mesquite trees. For example, in this environment, there has not been much invasion by the mesquite because the depth to the petrocalcic horizon is quite deep. Yet in other areas where the petrocalcic horizon is very shallow, there's been much more invasion. So the site is less resistant to invasion by this shrub, small tree species, and once we get the invasion, the site is less resilient. It's not going to recover as quickly or possibly ever. Moving to Utah here in eastern Utah, the Colorado Plateau physiographic region is a hot spot in terms of rare plant endemism. So we've done some work here where we find, this is Jones cycladinia. Cycladinia humilis jonesii is on the federally listed threatened list. And in a place where there's very low plant cover, very shallow soils, we often find an inverted organic carbon profile because there are no roots in the surface, and most of the roots are plastered up against what most plants think as the root-restricting layer, the shale environment. But here, these plants seem to have found their niche in the landscape with the roots down up against the shale and very little competition from your normally common plants. We see this over and over in the Colorado Plateau. Here's a spot a little bit farther north on the Tavaputs Plateau, south of the Uinta Basin, where we have the shrubby reed mustard, Shoena crombie suffrutescens, which is on the federally listed endangered list. And the soils are typically less than 30 centimeters deep. So typical of the Green River Formation, or found in the Green River Formation, but only in very, very few places of the Green River Formation. Shallow soils, again, very little plant cover. And so someday I hope before I retire is to get that unifying concept of soil, the role of soil in plant endemism and rarity in the Colorado Plateau. And I think a large part of it is physically restricting soil environments. We're always looking, you know, ecologists are always looking, what's the pH? It's got to be a selenium accumulator or it's uranium. And in many cases, I think the largest controlling factor is having a very shallow soil that limits most of your common arid species, and we have these rare endemics that can survive. Give a plug here, my postdoc, Lorene Kelly, is going to talk about this on Wednesday morning, some of the work she's been doing out here. So low plant cover allows us to actually use the soil signature, the geomorphological landform signature, to map soils. So I'm going to talk a little bit now about the SCORPAN model that was introduced by McBratney and others in a Geoderma article in 2003, where we basically take Yenny's soil-forming factors and realizing that soil itself can be an input into these factors. We're interested in that spatial position as well. So these SCORPAN factors is the foundation of digital soil mapping. So digital soil mapping is the creation and the population of a geographically referenced soil database at a given resolution. We need both field backed up by laboratory observations. We're looking also at environmental data. What kind of data can we represent digitally? So digital elevation models, remotely sensed data. And then we're going to take all of this and develop quantitative relationships to predict the distribution of soils on the landscape. So we take these soil-forming factors, we call them now environmental covariates, recognizing that soil, the plant cover, the landform, landscape position are going to co-vary, vary together on the landscape. An example here is in the Circle Cliffs of Utah. The climate is arid. In this area, pinyon juniper is the community, the plant community. And it's typically on this very dissected landscape of Moencopie Formation, which is an iron oxide-rich shale. And the soils are all shallow rocky soils. So contrary to what we think about in humid environments, the trees are often on the shallowest rocky soils, and the grasslands are actually on some of the deeper soils with a finer surface texture. So we're going to focus on these feedbacks. So an example of some of these feedbacks, we go to Cache Valley, Utah, up here in northern Utah, an area near Richmond, Utah. This is an alfalfa field, healthy vegetation. It's going to be green. We have these saline spots on the landscape where saltgrass, Disticulus spigatum, has dominated. And these are the areas where shallow to a saline water table and salts and sodium can accumulate in the environment. We can focus on these differences, realizing that healthy green vegetation is going to absorb the red visible radiation and reflect the near-infrared radiation. This is an area from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, where along the river we have high plant cover, cottonwood trees, a lot of grasses and forbs on the surface, and then we have areas that are the Powder River breaks, Powder River Badlands, where we have very little vegetation cover. We can use that vegetation signature, the normalized difference vegetation index, the near infrared where healthy vegetation reflects minus the red where it absorbs radiation, do this normalized ratio, near infrared minus red divided by near infrared plus the red, which in Landsat is bands 4 and 3. So the dark areas, the black areas, for example, the interstate highway that runs through has no vegetation, whereas areas with high vegetation in this image are going to have the white images. We can take this data, this real biophysical data sensed from a satellite, and put it into a quantitative model with observations in the field, with support in the laboratory, to predict soil distribution on the landscape. Another example here is back in Utah. We're in the San Francisco Mountains, down into the Big Wash area west of Milford, Utah. And it's an area of sedimentary rocks that have been intruded by volcanics. For example, there's this little volcanic peak here. Mineralogy is often represented well by shortwave infrared radiation. So something we found very useful has been Landsat 5 and 7, the shortwave bands, and ASTER bands 4 through 9. We've used this successfully to differentiate between sedimentary and igneous rocks, and these igneous intrusions following it into the mixed basin fill. When we were out here looking at the soils before we did any spectral work, we were finding this area of the alluvial fan, the vegetation changed. We went from having an Artemisia tridentata, so big sagebrush dominated area, to having a lot of shad scale, the Atriplex convertifolia coming in. Well, it turns out that once we saw the imagery, this highly siliceous volcanic intrusion, the materials, you can trace them down the alluvial fan where you had lower amounts of carbonate, higher amounts of silica, less buffering capacity, higher pH, and the shad scale was in the soil or on these geomorphic surfaces. Just to give you an idea, we had the spectral reflectance of the mineral calcite in yellow. Then we have the clay mineral silicate clay, montmorillonite, a smectite. And then we have the iron oxide hematite. Very different spectral signatures that with remote sensing sensors that are publicly available, free data out there, we can pick up in the shortwave infrared example 5-7 here for Landsat, very different signatures in the shortwave infrared for calcite versus montmorillonite versus hematite. Okay. Last spot here, give you a case study we worked on in the Colorado Plateau, the San Rafael Swell area. It's a fantastic area. We have these bands of parent materials that are exposed because of sedimentary layers that have been tilted and then the surface eroded. And, of course, there are a lot of salt-affected soils out there, soils with gypsum. If we were just to look at the visible radiation, so kind of like a photograph out there, we see that there's different colors of rocks, but if we look at the shortwave bands, we're now looking here at 7, 5, and 1 in blue, green, and red, we can see that what looks like a white area in the visible image is an area actually of gypsiferous soils. Typical rock outcrop still looks white in the image that's enhancing the shortwave infrared. Gypsum. Highly gypsiferous soils with a nice biological soil crust, very distinctive signatures in the Landsat 5 and 7 bands, and eventually allowing us to produce a thematic output where we can map these superficially gypsiferous soils. So my time is out. I covered a lot through there, and appreciate your attention.
Thanks.